Birds gotta fly and fish gotta swim. But fish also have to communicate. We're only just discovering now that fish have subtle ways of sending each other messages, including through odors from chemicals they release into the water. But as we learn more about how fish communicate chemically, we're also learning how human activity may be disrupting their conversation. Dr. Susie Curie from the Department of Biology at Mount Allison University in New Brunswick has discovered that a commonly found pollutant can disrupt the fishy chat, and this can be very bad news for the fish. Dr. Curie, welcome to Quirks and Quarks.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Which fish were you studying?
We were studying the banded killifish, which is a commonly found shoaling or schooling species of fish that's found locally within Atlantic Canada all the way down to the northern tip of South Carolina.
And how big is it?
Very small, actually, about 5-6 centimeters.
Oh, sort of like a minnow?
Yeah, it kind of looks like a minnow. It's a really beautiful banded pattern, hence the name banded killifish.
Ah. How do they communicate chemically?
They use chemical cues, probably odorants that are released from the fish, such that fish that smell like one another will be attracted to one another, really like it is with us as well.
So what's the message they're sending to each other?
Well, they're really giving information about the habitat, where they are, where the food is, and also their species. So these chemical cues really prevent species from mating with one another as well.
So how important is that communication?
So these fish they want to form these groups, which can be small groups of 10 or 20 or even larger groups in the hundreds. And they form these schools largely through these chemical cues, and it allows them to avoid predators, detect prey, locate food sources, determine habitats. So it's a defensive mechanism.
Oh, I see. So they know that I'm part of this pack, not that pack.
Exactly. And the stronger the chemical cue, the more cohesive or tightly packed the shoal.
What was the chemical pollutant that you were concerned about?
We were looking at a chemical called 4-nonylphenol, and it's a synthetic chemical that's a breakdown product of a group of chemicals known as the alkyl phenol ethoxylates. And
yes,
quite a mouthful. I had to practice that. But these alkyl phenol ethoxylates are very widespread. They're used in many industries, pulp and paper, textiles, metals, plastics. They're used as emulsifiers in agricultural pesticides, household detergents, industrial detergents. And 4-nonylphenol is one of many breakdown products of this group of chemicals, and it's actually found to be more persistent and more toxic than the parent compound.
Boy, how common is it in the waterways?
It's pretty common. Canadian water guidelines give recommendations for levels of nonylphenol that are acceptable for aquatic life. And these are around 1 microgram per liter. But you can find 4-nonylphenol, particularly abundant in wastewater effluents, the effluents coming from sewage treatment plants, but you'll also find it in surface waters. So concentrations in these wastewaters and these effluents can be 10 times the guidelines, 100 times the guidelines.
So tell me about your experiment. How did you study this in the lab?
What we did is we had a test fish in the center of an aquarium, or a focal fish, and we gave that fish a choice of associating with clean water or associating with a water plume that contained the chemical cues of a group of fish. And of course, fish want to associate with fish that smell like them. So we could see that the fish wanted to associate with the chemical cue arising from the shoal.
Okay, so that's their natural behavior.
That's
right?
Their natural behavior.
Okay.
However, when we added a group of dosed fish, dosed now with the 4-nonylphenol at these low levels for just an hour, the focal fish or the test fish actively oriented away from that plume of water. They did not want to associate with the water plume that smelled like the nonylphenol. It disrupted or somehow obscured the natural chemical signature of their shoaling companions.
Wow. So it just didn't like the smell of the group.
It didn't like the smell of the group.
So does that mean it was having trouble identifying the group? Or?
Well, we also dosed the focal fish, that central test fish, and we found that when we dosed that fish, it did not change the behavior at all, in that the fish correctly oriented towards the chemical cues coming from their shoaling mates. So it appears that the 4-nonylphenol does not affect the ability of the fish to detect the chemical cues, but it somehow obscures or affects the chemical signature or the chemical signal coming from the fish.
Oh, okay. So the fish doesn't mind his own smell.
Exactly.
Well, what's it mean for them in terms of, if this signaling is disrupted, what's it mean for the fish in the wild?
Well, it's probably going to increase predation on these fish. This particular species has many, you know, birds will prey on them, as well as eels, larger fish species. So they'll be more prone to attack as this shoal is disrupted. If these large shoals break up, it'll be more difficult to get food, to find mates. So there are many, many downstream consequences. And again, these are very low levels that we used, and for very brief periods of time. Other effects of these sorts of chemicals have usually looked at physiological measures or toxicity tests. What we're finding here are these very significant behavioral effects on very low levels. You would not be able to detect these effects if we were using physiological or molecular markers of toxicity.
Yeah, it's interesting. Usually when you think about pollutants, you think about them as like a poison.
Exactly.
But in this case, it's behavior that's
It's behavior. And, you know, very low levels, short periods of time, short pulses. So this is something that the fish will definitely encounter in the wild. And remember, too, that these chemical contaminants, they change spatially and temporally. So you can have pulses of them. They're persistent. They can accumulate to very, very high levels in sediments. So there's also the potential of soil erosion that could actually cause further influx of these contaminants into the water column as well.
So what's the bigger issue here?
Well, I think we have to really rethink the dosage guidelines for these contaminants. As I said, right now, it's about 1 microgram per liter in Canadian systems. And this is highlighting a gap, I think, when these doses are set using measures of toxicity or physiological changes, when behavior is actually a very subtle, very sensitive measure of the effects on aquatic life.
How easy is it going to be to do that? Because you say that these chemicals are used in everything from detergents to pulp and paper.
That's true, although they were far more widespread a few years ago. A few years ago, all of North America decided to voluntarily omit the use of these surfactants, these detergents, in household detergents. So they have been decreasing, and only last year, I believe, nonylphenol became a toxic, according to the Canadian Environmental Protection Agency. So there have been strides with such research, looking at toxicity, looking at physiology, and now hopefully looking at behavior. I think we're making strides to reduce and hopefully eliminate the use of these contaminants in Canadian waters.
Do you think there's going to be more effort towards looking for these subtle effects from pollutions that affect behavior?
I do. There is some evidence of this in the literature already. We're not the first to look at behavior, but it's a fairly new field, and I think the evidence is accumulating that this is a much more sensitive determinant of the effects of contaminants.
Dr. Curry, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Susie Curry is a professor in the Department of Biology at Mount Allison University in Sackville, New Brunswick. Before we go, we thought you might want to hear about an interesting new series beginning next week on the CBC radio program Ideas. It's called How to Think About Science, and it kicks off next Wednesday evening at 9 p.m., comprising 25 broadcasts in all, the programs will run on Wednesday nights, with a few interruptions, until the end of June. The central idea is that a new way of thinking about science has been gradually emerging in recent years. Old myths about the scientist as sage and science as a mirror held up to nature have been replaced by a view of science as a less certain and more creative activity. Science has lost some of its privilege, its special status as a form of knowledge, and come down to earth as a social institution like any other. Prepared by David Cayley, the Ideas series will feature many of the thinkers who have made this revolution in thought, philosophers, historians, sociologists, and even a poet. How to Think About Science begins next Wednesday evening on Ideas on CBC Radio 1. Hope you can catch it. And that's it for this week's edition of Quirks and Quarks. Next week, Good Calories, Bad Calories. A new book challenges almost everything we've been told about diet, weight control, and disease. If you'd like to get in touch with us, you can write to Quirks and Quarks, P.O. Box 500, Station A, Toronto, Ontario, M5W1E6. Our email is quirks@cbc.ca. And to get to our webpage, just go to cbc.ca/quirks, where you can subscribe to our podcast, sign up for our weekly newsletter, listen to our audio archives, and check out our latest blog. Quirks and Quarks is produced by Jim Hanman, Jim Lebbins, Pat Sensen, and Zara Lurie, with technical help from Tim Lorimer. I'm Bob McDonald. Thanks for listening.